My memory of him going back to Rosewood was just a horror show. He would scream and he would yell and he'd hang onto the banister and weep and wail and say, "Don't take me back."
The Times said nothing about Westchester or real estate. The New York Times instead reported that my dad was once a notorious gangster.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Hinken.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
This week on the podcast, Family Secrets, two stories about children refusing to stay mum about things their parents would prefer not to discuss.
Before we get started, we want to thank the Park School of Baltimore, an independent co-ed non-sectarian progressive pre-K through grade 12 school. So this first story is told by a fascinating woman named Powell Welliver. And if you've been to Stoop shows before or you listen to the podcast, you may recognize her voice or her name. She has shared stories before. This particular story is one of my favorite types in the sense that it is a personal story about a specific set of circumstances, but it opens a window into a history of a late 20th century, sort of mid-20th century history that all of us have been touched by in some way. And so, yeah, her family story is riveting and also tells us something about the way we used to think as a culture and behave. So anyway, take a listen.
I have to take you back. I've got to take you back because this story could not happen today. And I thank God it could not happen today. So I'm going to take you back to 1948. And remember, just a few years after World War II. And my mother and father met and had sex and got pregnant. And so they had to get married. So they got married in 1949 and had a child in 1949. And because my grandfather and my uncle were prominent surgeons at Johns Hopkins, my parents had to hide the pregnancy. They were forced to leave town, and they moved to a tiny little town outside of Toledo, Ohio, where they had no friends. He worked. Mom died if she didn't have a million people to talk to, so I don't know how she'd live those 2 years without anybody. But she had my brother in a tiny little hospital near Toledo, and it was not Johns Hopkins. So it was very bad, and my brother was brain damaged during childbirth. And my father still remembers the forcep marks in the head, and I don't think my mother woke up for a couple days because the anesthesiologist was drunk. So there you go. So my brother was born, and I came along supposedly 9 months later. An Irish twin, I was always told. They were then allowed to move back to Baltimore because by then you couldn't really tell how old my brother was. But the trouble was my brother kind of stopped talking. And my grandfather said, "Well, he's deaf. You've got to do something about this." So they went from one doctor to another to another. And then they found Dr. Kanner. And if anybody knows about autism, you know that Dr. Leo Kanner was kind of the grandfather of autism. He used the word, I think, for the first time. My brother was diagnosed as autistic, which meant he was going to be strange and different, kicked out of kindergarten, couldn't go to any of the schools I was going to. Nobody knew what to do with him. But thank God we were in Baltimore now. And Miss Jean Simmons started a school called Linwood in Ellicott City. It's still going. The mission of Linwood back in 1955 was to save kids from going to Rosewood State Hospital. That was her purpose in life. She took my brother on. He stayed there till he was 12. He loved Miss Simmons, loved going to school. But as Miss Simmons said, he was a failure of hers. He had to leave. My father didn't remember why. He blanked out everything. He blanked out everything with my brother. So, at this point, my grandfather said, "You've got to get rid of your son because he has three sisters. You cannot have that boy acting out around his sisters. I think at this point, if I remember right, he was starting to use the F word. He was noticing the difference between girls and boys, you know, and he was acting out. So he was sent to Rosewood. And Rosewood was a hellhole. It was horrible. It was horrible for my brother, who had lived a fairly nice childhood at that point because he'd been at Linwood. And at this point, he wasn't living a happy childhood. He was surrounded by Rosewood's State Hospital was built for imbeciles and the retarded. And that's the kind, you can kind of guess the kind of people he was surrounded by. He would be allowed to come home on occasion. He was allowed to come home on Christmas, but he was never allowed to take any Christmas presents back with him because everything would be destroyed when he hit Rosewood. My memory of him going back to Rosewood was just a horror show. He would scream and he would yell and he'd hang onto the banister and weep and wail and say, "Don't take me back there." And when she got to Rosewood, there would be two men waiting to drag him out of the car and take him to his room. My brother was there for several years, and when he hit his 20s, I'm fine. I've got my own Kleenex, thank you. I'm fine. I'll make it. When he hit his 20s, and he had a speech impediment, so when he'd come home and he'd dare go out of the house, we're not allowed to have friends. We're not allowed to talk about him to anybody. We were not to discuss the fact that we had this brother that we basically threw away. And sometimes he'd walk down to a bus stop or something and try to do something, and he'd come back all beaten up, and kids would have taken his stuff and torn his shirt and taken his bus money, and he just couldn't understand it because Robin was such a sweet soul. He looked to the stars. He thought the stars and the planets were the most magnificent thing. And at Christmas time, sometimes he talked to one of my cousins, and his brother is here today, would talk about the stars and the planets, and he would say this. And my brother was one of the examples of Rain Man. Dr. Kanner was asked to help with case studies, and my brother was one of the case studies that the writer read, because my brother could remember any weather of any day that he could. You could say, how about September 30th, 1961? And he'd say, 60 degrees, and it was sunny all day long. It was a good day. And he could remember all those things. So he was very special if you got to know him, but most people didn't get to know him. But he came to his counselor when he was about 23, I'm figuring. And he said to his counselor, "I'm not retarded, and I need to get out of here. You're going to help me, aren't you?" And the counselor said, "Okay, we're going to figure out a plan here." So my brother knew how to read and he knew how to write. He knew how to do change. He knew the bus system. They went and taught him how to do the bus system. He was working in sheltered workshops. Thank you, God, for BARC. I give a shout out for BARC. Wonderful organization. They helped him through all the different things, and he realized the greenhouse was his love. He loved plants. And if you ever go down York Road and you see the BARC truck pulled over and they're doing landscaping, think of my brother and how proud he was. I've got a picture of him coming out of the truck of BARC, just standing there. He was so proud to have a job. He went to the job every day. He learned how to take the bus. And finally, they realized they could put some of these young men into apartments. And my brother was one of the first nine who got put into separate apartments. You had to learn how to cook, take the bus. You had to have a job. You had to be able to do change. You had to pay your own bills. You had to buy your own clothes. I have books of all the things that he bought. He was so proud to have shoes that he owned. He was so proud to have a TV, a little TV that he was able to buy for himself. And he wanted to vote, and he registered to vote, and people came out in protest against the retarded voting, And that was what was shown on TV. We never told him that because that would have just been horrible. Meanwhile, I had tried to teach him. The most heartbreaking thing is when he would say, why can't I go to school like you? And I said, I can't tell you why. There just aren't special schools. And he says, I just want to go to school. And I said, I know, you can't do it because there's no programs like that at that point. So there he was working every day. Meant everything to him to do that. Everything to him. One day the bus must have come early or he was a couple minutes late. He saw that bus going down. That's all he could see. That was my bus. I have to be on that bus. He ran across the road to the bus and was killed by a car. And it was just horrible. And actually, my cousin here, thank you, God, he's the one who identified the body. He took that burden away from my family. And I thank him for it because it was so horrible. And it was like that call where my father said, come home now, come home now. I'm a lawyer. And I just knew the voice. And I didn't believe it. I said, he can't have a car accident. He doesn't drive. I mean, I couldn't comprehend what happened for a while. And my father made the decision, no obituary, because he hadn't told the people he worked with, most of them, that he had a son. He said, no, we're not doing this. No. Now, he did have a funeral, and the people who knew about Robin came, and, of course, I had another cousin, not the one here, the cousin who said, oh, aren't you glad? It's all over. It's done. And I said, no, I am not. And it was very, very hard for me. The guilt that you feel as a sibling when you're able to do things and your sibling wants to do what you're doing and they can't and they're blocked because of it. It is so painful, the guilt. But what I learned recently, because I didn't know my parents were pregnant when they got married. So we celebrated Robin's birthday 9 months to the day from their wedding date to make it all legit. Okay? But guess what? He must have been born 4 or 5 months earlier. And my brother never got a chance to celebrate his real birthday. He never knew how old he was, even though he'd write to Miss Simmons and he'd say, I'm 16 and 3/4 years old, and I love you, Miss Simmons, and I want to come back. Please let me come back. And my mother wouldn't mail the letter. She would just keep them. So we found them and everything. So my brother had a secret birth, secret life, secret death. But I'm going to tell you something. I always wanted to have a big brother that could protect me at the playground. Big brother I could say, yes, that's my big brother, you know. But you know, Robin gave me much more. He gave me the ability to understand that you can do so much more with your life than you ever dream of if you want to. You can be kind to people and take bullying and take it in and still be kind to people and still love people and get joy out of every day of the life you're living. So what more can anybody ask for from a brother but that? Thank you.
So that story was the first story, I think, where I've ever, like, started crying on stage. Like, I couldn't get it together when I came out after she was done. I think because I just felt so, A, she told it so powerfully. B, I felt so connected to it personally because I had myself done my internship at Lynnwood Children's Center, and Gene Simmons, who she talks about, not the lead singer of Kiss, but the
but that pioneer. Leads to our previous episode on heavy metal.
Gene Simmons had been my mentor. So I had sat with her like every afternoon for 2 hours for a semester and just heard her kind of pontificate. And then, you know, cut to who I am now, where I have a daughter that has a genetic disorder, and I work in the field of autism. So, it hit me. It got me.
Yeah, and just I used to drive by Rosewood the way to work.
Yeah.
And that place is so mythic and so legendary. I remember there was a story about...
so sad.
Yeah, there's just... they used to take girls who were institutionalized there and farm them out to work as maids in rich people's homes. And the rich people would like get these daughters, these girls to work for them for next to nothing. So there was just these whole systems that were based on the idea that these were throwaway people. Mm-hmm. And the place just seems haunted. And it's in this, it's on this beautiful plot of land, but it's, yeah, that's a haunted place. Anyway, before we get to our second story for the podcast today, we want to thank Baltimore Magazine, which chronicles and celebrates our complicated town. You can find them on the newsstands or baltimoremagazine.com, and they have a great podcast called Local Flavor Live, which is about eats around town. We'd also like to thank Golden West, which is an omni restaurant that has been on the Avenue in Hamden since 1997. They have a vegan forward menu, and they have a late night carryout window.
Okay, so this next storyteller is, he actually came to the show directly from New York. It was a rainy night. He took the train, then he took a cab, and he just was a consummate gentleman from a different era. He was in a, you know, a
navy
suit,
blue blazer.
Navy blue blazer, and just such a good, wonderful man that we got to meet through this whole thing that we do. He is actually the father of a friend of mine, and so she'd been talking him up for years. He desperately wanted to tell this story. We let him, and he knocked it out of the park. Please give it a listen.
Come back with me to 1996, which judging by the demographic tonight, might not be too difficult. For those of you not in that demographic, that is before Facebook and before Google and before I had white hair. And that summer, I was sitting in my office in New York in Midtown, and one of my colleagues brought to me an article in the New York Times. It was about my Uncle Sherman Billingsley. And again, if you're a certain age, you remember the store club, and my uncle owned that. But when I was handed the article, that's not what piqued my interest, because I'd gotten rather blasé because I'd heard about my uncle a lot. What piqued my interest is that I saw my dad's name. My dad was named Logan Billingsley, and he was Sherman's big brother. And he died 30 years before that. Now, my dad was not a celebrity. He was a highly respected developer in northern Westchester, very successful. And that's where my brothers and I grew up with my mother. My dad was 64 when I was born. That always gets a rise out of people. So does the next line, and I have a younger brother. My dad was a tall man, an aloof man, and he spent very little time, if any, with his sons. And I always wanted to be with him. He was a god. I admired him and I loved him. And I was crushed when he died when I was 16. So you can imagine my euphoria that day in my office, you know, to see my dad, and he was not a celebrity, and he's in the New York Times. Wow, you know? And I sat down, and I started reading, and halfway through, I stopped breathing. Because the Times said nothing about Westchester or real estate. The New York Times instead reported that my dad was once a notorious gangster. An infamous bootlegger, wanted in 10 states, frequently in jail, and when he was 21, he'd shot and killed a man in Oklahoma. Now, I was just, you can understand how he reacted. I mean, I'm a pretty button-down guy, right? I mean, and people who look like me and talk like me, you know, we don't have relatives like this. So I didn't know what to do. I was in free fall because I'd never heard a whisper about this, either before or after my dad died. So like all sons in panic, I called up my mom, who is 84, and she was still a stickler for good manners. And I said, "Mom, did you see the article about Sherman?" And she said, "Yes," and it was all total lies from beginning to end. And I'll never forget her, and I could see that finger wagging over the phone. "Bobby, you know your father was a great man, and he could never do anything like that." Whoa. Where was I gonna go from there? So it may sound crazy, but I decided that I was gonna act like I believed my mom. Why? Well, it hurt. I mean, this man was my idol. I was going to be a respected man like him. It was crushing. Also, I was petrified. If the Times had come up with this SHIT in one day, what else was out there, huh? And also, too, I have a, you know, low threshold of embarrassment. You know, I'm a very waspy guy. So my mother, I gave her a pass. You know, dutiful son, I'm not going to hurt my mom. I gave her a pass then. My dad, though, oh, that was a whole other story. Because Mr. Civic Pillar was really, you know, Mr. Crook. So I felt sick to my stomach to sort of lose the man that I idealized. And also, I felt like a damn fool. Here, I'd emulated this guy who was supposed to be this way, and he was this, like this lower species, and I was really pissed off, and I just put him out of my life pretty successfully. And then about a dozen years after that, my mom dies, and I'm cleaning out her bedroom. You know what's coming, right? Yeah. I'm not going to tell you. So I'm cleaning out her bedroom, and it's behind her shoes is this black metal box, you know? And I go there, and I open it up, and there is this stack of newspaper clippings, front page stuff, from circa 1918, okay? And I start reading it, and the Seattle Times says, and I quote, "Logan Billingsley is the underworld boss of the Pacific Northwest." Followed by the Detroit Free Press, which described my dad as, quote, "the king of the Michigan bootleggers." And to complete the cross-country aspect of this, there's the Buffalo Standard, which says he's the most amazing bootlegger in America. So where did I go with this? I went back to my mom, and I sort of said, okay, this is the proof that, ha-ha, you really did lie back in 1996, and the New York Times didn't lie then. But what got me was that she'd held this secret for 50 years. All of my life, but yet she kept the proof of her lie. So I'll talk about my mother in the next story you give me. But what happens is that, curiously, I go back and I read the articles again. And slowly I'm thinking, my dad was pretty cool. Especially, you know, compared to me, my wife has said I have a navy blue heart and pretty conservative guy. And he was so bigger than life, you know, and to think this Oklahoma desperado was my dad. And you know, my dad, he sawed his way out of a prison cell in Seattle. He carried a pistol, you know, as casually as I carry a handkerchief. He, Oklahoma sheriffs chased him for 15 years. It could never catch him. And he'd been married three times before he'd been married to my mother. So my dad was a total stranger. An intriguing total stranger, but my dad was a total stranger. So time goes on. I turn 70. I know you don't believe that. And I mellow, as my daughter Kate would say. And I'm a grandfather, Charlie, you know, the man. And we talk a lot, and I'm making sure I tell him all about my past and my family history, even though I know so little about my dad. And I get sad. I think, you know, if I could just had a time machine, I could go back. But that's not going to happen, right? But what is going to happen is that I'm learning about my dad and I'm connecting to it that way. And I've been traveling to Oklahoma City, to Detroit, to Seattle, of course, to Des Moines, to Salt Lake City, and I've been to all the towns where he bootlegged. And I've been to all the places that were his drugstores, because that's how this booze was sold, illegal booze anyway. And I've been to all of the jails that he escaped from, the last count, five. And I'm writing a book about this. Yeah, yeah. And I've learned that a son... looking for his father's love and approval is such a powerful thing, even when you're 73. Thank you.
When he is crying, you know, when he is choked up, it makes me think of somewhere I read someone smart said, you know, we are all children for so long. Like, yeah. we are. And we, you know, we want our parents' love so badly, even when we're 70, like he is, you know. And I thought that that was so authentic to just who we are as people. Because you don't often see, I mean, a guy of his stature and age really being that white guy, like being vulnerable on stage like that.
And it's so just, emotionally intelligent.
Yeah.
And reflective.
Yeah, right. Because like older white men haven't had to be very insightful because, you know, they
most
rule the world, you know. Yeah. So it was just unusual and surprising in all the good ways. So that is our story on Family Secrets. I feel that we could do a million more shows on Family Secrets.
It's Laura's favorite theme.
That is, yes. But for now, we will end by thanking the Baltimore Center Stage, which is presenting Where We Stand. It's a brand new play of penance that's filled with humor, heart, and music. And it's running April 2nd to April 26th. At Baltimore Center Stage. You can find tickets at centerstage.com. And we want to thank The Wine Source, located at 3601 Elm Avenue in Hamden. Great place for wine, beer, cheese, coffee, all sorts of goodies, and they're real good people.
Please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. And you can find out more about our live shows and workshops at soupstorytelling.com.
We do have a live show coming up on March 31st. It's called Of Substance, and it's a show featuring stories about our relationship with drugs and alcohol. That's a free show, so please check it out, soupstorytelling.com.
We want to thank Maureen Harvey, our wonderful producer. Have a good week.
We'll see you next week.